Aquifers and watersheds. Understanding our water resources. A production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Episode 6. Wisconsin Aquifers. Cambrian, Precambrian, and Confined. Hello, and thanks for joining us. This episode will conclude our explanation of the types of aquifers found in Wisconsin, which should provide you with strong fundamentals for understanding aquifers in any part of the world. There's a lot of geology in this episode, so fittingly, David Krabbenhoft from the United States Geological Survey returns as our guide. Let's pick up the conversation.
The next aquifer in terms of age in Wisconsin is what we call the Cambrian aquifer, and that's a geologic term for everything that happened in between what we call the Precambrian, so that's a very old geologic time frame, to more recent times, maybe only many tens of thousands of years old. Everywhere in between about a billion years old and a few tens of thousands of years old is called the Cambrian. There's a lot of aquifers that are utilized in Wisconsin, mostly in the southern half of the state, areas like La Crosse and Madison and Milwaukee and Appleton and Green Bay and Door County. All those areas withdraw water from what we call the Cambrian aquifer system. And the Cambrian aquifer system is made up of several different named geologic units. There are things like the Silurian aquifer or the Ordovician aquifer or the specific rock units sometimes they'll be referred to as, like the St. Peter sandstone, or sometimes you'll hear another rock unit called the Trempealeau sandstone. All those rock units are all Cambrian in age. So again, hundreds of millions of years old, but the water that's inside those units is much, much younger than that, generally only hundreds of years old. And that's because an aquifer, it yields water. If it doesn't yield water, if you can't extract water from it, then it's not an aquifer. So as long as you can withdraw water from it, it's an aquifer. But if you can withdraw water from it, then water flows through it. And so that's why the water inside these aquifers, the aquifer rocks themselves might be many hundreds of millions of years old, but the water in there is only maybe a few hundred years old. And that's because the flow path through the aquifer might be a few hundred miles long, and yet that water is maybe only moving about a foot a day. That would be a typical scale for the Cambrian aquifer, maybe tens to 100 mile long flow path length from the first time the water entered the aquifer until it comes out, wherever there's a pumping well or something that extracted the water out. So there's this continual flushing of water. So while 100 to many hundreds of years old of water flow path through the aquifer might seem long to some people, if you consider that that aquifer has actually been there for hundreds of millions of years, it's been flushed through many, many, many times over and over again by water slowly flowing through it.
So what's that third main aquifer in Wisconsin that you were mentioning?
The third aquifer in Wisconsin is what we call the Precambrian system, and that's the oldest. So again, we're talking many, many hundreds of millions to billions of years old, and it's the underlying geologic bedrock, not only for the state of Wisconsin, but for this whole region. And those rocks are mostly granitic, a form of granite, crystalline bedrock. So these are the rocks that actually yield the least amount of water in general. Sometimes they can be highly cracked up and fractured, and so they can contain a lot of water that we can actually extract. But in a lot of areas, that granitic bedrock is actually still in original shape, and so there's very few cracks or points at which we could put a well down in and extract water. In areas of geologic uplift or compression where that bedrock will get cracked, you can get more and more water to infiltrate into it, and then we as humans can put down a well and extract out of those cracked zones. And I think a good example of that would be the area around Wausau. There's a big uplift of the Wisconsin granite at that location. So if you're driving from the southern part of Wisconsin up to your favorite lake in northern Wisconsin, you'll notice right as you're entering the municipality of Wausau, all of a sudden you'll come up a big hill. And if you look left or you look right, you'll also see the granitic outcrop of the Wisconsin granite. And what's happened there geologically is we've had an uplift or a geologic rise of that rock from below, pressure lifting that granitic material upwards. And as it lifted it up, it also cracked it. That granite we can see at the surface in Wausau because it got lifted up and slowly everything above that got eroded away. And so we get to see that bedrock. Well, that same bedrock exists in southern Wisconsin too, but it's hundreds of feet down. It's not that it's not there, it just hasn't been uplifted. And in southern Wisconsin, it's overlain by those Cambrian aquifers. So in general, a lot of times that Precambrian aquifer contains very good water. It's just not as reliable that you can find it because you're relying on cracks and other means to be able to move water both into and then out of an otherwise very hard rock unit.
This Precambrian aquifer, is that what they call a confined aquifer?
In some areas, the Precambrian aquifer is confined. In others, it's not. The way we differentiate between it being confined or not is whether or not it is essentially trapped from on top by a very tight rock unit, typically something like a shale or something similar to a very fine-grained rock unit that's not an aquifer. We call those aquitards. What they are impediments to water flow and impediments to water transport. They also, though, provide a really important function to the hydrology of a watershed. If you have a confined aquifer, which means a deep one that has a rock unit above it that's essentially capping it and preventing communication and transport and exchange of water from above, you can create an aquifer that's highly pressurized because there's essentially no way for the water to get out without something like a well installed into it. So water continues flowing into that deep aquifer system from, again, up high or in the watershed where the water infiltrates and comes in. But if there's a unit that we call an aquitard, it keeps any of that water from getting out naturally to any significant degree. What that causes is an overpressuring of the system. If we put a well into that system that's been overpressurized because of the existence of this cap or this thing that keeps the pressure from being dissipated, we have a situation where the water level in a well tapped into a deep confined aquifer is commonly above the level of the water table or above the level of the land surface. So if you can put in a well into a situation like that, it will freely flow without need for a pump to withdraw the water.
Is that what they mean by artesian wells?
Yes, that is exactly what an artesian well is. It's a well placed into an aquifer that's overpressured and will flow without the need for any kind of assistance such as a pump. One of the people who originally sorted out how that comes about was a gentleman who eventually became provost of the University of Wisconsin, a gentleman by the name of Chamberlain, for which Chamberlain Hall is named.
Thomas Chamberlain was a groundbreaking American geologist who lived from 1843 to 1928. Among many accomplishments, he helped conduct a comprehensive geological survey of Wisconsin in 1873. Chamberlain was one of the first to recognize that multiple episodes of glaciation had occurred during the Pleistocene, and his terminology for these glacial stages in North America is still in use. The geologic evidence he identified convinced him that the Earth was much older than was assumed by scientists of the time. Chamberlain became chief geologist for the Wisconsin Geological Survey in 1876, supervising the final completion of the survey and their subsequent multi-volume report. His work on Precambrian bedrock geology, soils, and artesian wells brought him national renown and led to his appointment as head of the Glacial Division of the United States Geological Survey in 1881. He later became president of the University of Wisconsin from 1887 to 1892, and generations of students, including your narrator, have taken science classes in Chamberlain Hall over the years. Craters on Mars and on the Moon are named in his honor. This whole mission of taking care of water resources, it's important work that you do. Who do you work with, and how is it all connected together?
The Wisconsin Water Science Center of USGS, we only work through a vast network of what we call cooperators. And the cooperators that we work with can be an individual city or a municipality who needs our scientific expertise, understanding how the water resources of their jurisdiction. So if we're talking about the city of Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee has a defined political jurisdiction. And within that defined area of land, there is water in the form of creeks and streams and lakes, and they want to keep those healthy and intact for future generations. So our office will work with groups like that. But often, and frankly, probably more commonly, we actually partner with other science agencies and groups in the state to conduct our studies. And again, we do that in a cooperative sense where we like to have long-term relationships with groups like the State Geological and Natural History Survey, or groups like the Aquatic Sciences Center on the University of Wisconsin campus, or the Freshwater Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Those are just a few examples that I'm laying out now. We actually work with many, many groups and people. We do that to bring the most complete complement of science that we can to help address the real significant and important questions that surround keeping ample water supplies, but also high-quality water supplies for the citizens of Wisconsin. We work on very small projects, so an individual creek maybe that's receiving water off a farmed field. So we'll work with individual farmers to try and minimize the impact of fertilizer runoff or just impactful pathogens or anything of that kind, to working with very large groups to make sure that over a regional basis that the watersheds and the water resources are maintained in the best possible way that we can.
In the next episode, we'll be speaking with Julia Nordyke about some of the specific problems involving runoff and watersheds. Her work in outreach and the strategies that David just described are indicative of one of the powerful ways science works in the 21st century. In the 20th century, there was much specialization in the sciences as the knowledge base expanded. Now, as we seek practical application of that knowledge, scientists not only have to be highly skilled, but they also must possess the flexibility and intellectual strength to work in all manner of interdisciplinary and real-world situations in order to satisfactorily meet the challenges of today. Well, I'll be heading back into the field to speak with more researchers in the next few podcasts, so I do hope you'll join me. But before I go, if you happen to be wondering why artesian wells are not called Chamberlain wells, they were actually named for the province of Artois in medieval France, where many such wells were drilled by Carthusian monks in the 12th century. Carthusian monks are perhaps best remembered, however, for brewing chartreuse, a bright green French liqueur, first marketed in the 1700s, which is made from a secret recipe involving distilled alcohol aged with 130 herbs, plants, and flowers. The drink chartreuse has lent its name to the color chartreuse, which began to be known as a distinct shade in the 1880s. Chartreuse is said to be one of a handful of liquors that continues to age and improve in the bottle, which is probably where it belongs, as you'd likely turn chartreuse yourself if you drank very much of it. Well, that's all for now. Hang loose, avoid chartreuse, and I'll meet you in the next episode. This is Chris Bocast. Till next time. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Thanks for listening.